Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for December's Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, RZVS specialist in small animal surgery orthopaedics, Stephen Butterworth. Thank you, Stephen. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you for that. I hope everyone can hear me. Good afternoon and welcome to the webinar this week, which is entitled Fractures of the Humeral Condyle, an area that has interested me since I first came into orthopaedics more years ago than I care to remember. We will see some of the work that's been done on this as we go through. Now, in considering fractures of the humeral condyle, I've broken the talk down into the subheadings listed on this slide: classification, etiology, clinical signs, diagnosis, treatment, complications, and prognosis. So there's quite a lot to get through in the next hour, but should be an interesting time. The classification is somewhat clouded and somewhat confused by the fact that there is only one humeral condyle. So we cannot have fractures of the lateral humeral condyle or the medial humeral condyle. Often we refer to them as lateral or medial condylar fractures, which is correct, but often people lapse into misterminology, and I hope that I manage not to do so today. But I think everybody knows what we're talking about. We just need to be aware of the fact that there is actually only one humeral condyle. The lateral side of that is fractured in 56% of cases, the medial side in 9%, and the Y or T fracture, as it's best described, is in about 35%. The addition of the incomplete fracture or the humeral condylar fissure is almost a separate entity, and yet it is part of the same problem. So I haven't put a figure on that, but it is something that we will be talking about during this lecture or webinar. So the etiology. The first thing I think we need to contemplate is the fact that these are not random traumatic events. So what are they if they're not random and traumatic, and what evidence is there for that statement? Well, the first thing is the breed incidence. If we look at that in the UK and we take the four papers listed, which are going to be given in full at the end under references, so don't worry about scribbling anything down. Those four papers all come from a series of cases in the UK, and if we combine them all, we can see that the Springer Spaniel accounts for 20% across the board, lateral, medial, and intercondylar. That's out of 278 patients, and although we wouldn't really know what the percentage of Springer Spaniels there are in the dog population in the UK, I think we can be fairly certain that 20% is overrepresentative. Similarly for the Yorkshire Terrier, that 14% of that breed were involved. Interestingly though, their bias was towards a highish percentage, nearly as close as the Springer, for the lateral and medial condyle fractures, but the intercondylar drops to 8%. Reasons not known, but an interesting point. So that suggests, if there's a breed incidence, that this is not a random event. The second thing is that they often follow minor trauma. Again, if we define that as a fall or jump of less than 1 meter, and we take papers where or studies where the that was documented, and we combine those studies, then out of totals seen in the table, 69% of lateral condylar fractures were due to minor trauma or caused by minor trauma, 80% of medial, and 40% of intercondylar, which again across the board gives 60% due to minor trauma, and we don't expect that with other types of fracture. So it does beg the question, is there some form of weakness and a breed predisposition to such weakness? Some time ago, 1938, Shuttleworth described it or explained this as resulting from overloading of a poorly designed joint surface. That is just a hypothesis. He had no evidence for this, it's just a thought. The lateral epicondylar attachments were considered weaker, and the lateral component of the condyle is offset in a lateral direction, which increases the stress on the lateral attachments. That was his consideration, without any foundation other than literally anatomical observation. Since then, there have been many speculations about why the humeral condyle fractures with such regular occurrence. None of them have any substance, and that makes it difficult to progress with an etiology. Now, I, in 1992, for my diploma thesis, looked at condylar conformation to try and decide whether there was anything that we could see from an anatomical point of view that would back up these claims. Measured various radiographic parameters in the distal humerus. The normal population of dogs was taken as 50 patients that were being treated for non-orthopedic reasons. Well, treated is probably wrong, because some of them were being neutered and some were being investigated for incontinence. The fracture population was constituted 39 dogs that I had treated. So we looked at, or I looked at, a number of possible parameters, and the two that came out of greatest interest, where statistical difference was seen, was what was what I termed the epicondylar ratio of lateral over medial. So in the diagram on the left, that would be C over D. So we would be expecting the ratio to be less than one if the lateral epicondyle is, so to say, weaker than the medial epicondyle. And we looked at angle beta, which is seen on the right, which is the angle within the intercondylar notch. Now, that angle and the epicondylar ratio were the only two that showed any significance. Taking the epicondylar ratio, it was higher in the fracture population, which is not what we were expecting. And it was also higher in populations of Springer Spaniels. So from this measurement alone, the lateral epicondyle is relatively wider in both groups. Now, that's only a 2D measurement, but it certainly doesn't lend support for this being a weaker connection. If we look at angle beta, it was smaller in the fracture population. Now, that lends some credibility to the thoughts that the angle in that notch may predispose to forces, upwardly directed forces from the radius and ulna, causing separation of the two components of the condyle, much as a chisel would splice a piece of wood. So the more acute the angle, possibly the higher that risk. And it was shown that this was also smaller in Yorkshire Terriers, which might explain why Yorkshire Terriers are predisposed. However, the angle was larger than the normal population in Springer Spaniels. So the fracture population could make the condyle vulnerable, but that argument does not apply for Springer Spaniels. So again, something of a blank had been drawn. If we go back now to the age, this lack of it being a random traumatic incident, etiology and age. If we take the five studies listed there and look at the age distribution for those fractures, then we can see that 70% thereabouts of lateral condylar fractures and medial condylar fractures were less in patients less than 1 year of age. So there's a very strong pull towards youngsters. And in fact, the peak incidence is at 3 and 4 months of age. There's a secondary peak at about 4 years, but 3 and 4 months is a massive peak. Wright in 1937 suggested that that peak age might relate to the lack of union between the two components. So the lateral component and the medial component of the humeral condyle develop as separate centres of ossification, and those should fuse together by the time a puppy is about 5 months of age. So prior to that, there is a weak line of cartilage running through the condyle, which might make it predisposed to fracture. Then came along the concept of incomplete ossification of the humeral condyle, described by Marcellin Little in 1994. Now, he'd noticed that in 14 Cocker Spaniels in a series of 157 dogs with unilateral humeral condylar fractures, i.e. lateral or medial, 86% had a radiolucent line within the condyle of the normal limb. 43% had a periosteal reaction on the lateral epicondyle, and this would be in a fresh fracture. So why had there developed a periosteal reaction prior to bone injury? And he also noticed that many of them had osteoarthritis changes prior to injury with an abnormal coronoid process. So his thought was that IOHC is prevalent in Cocker Spaniels and predisposes to condylar fracture. But that's not necessarily true. It may be prevalent and not associated with an increased incidence at all. Martin and others in 2010 saw 14 cases of low trauma unilateral condylar fractures and investigated the contralateral condyle with radiography and CT, and 43% showed IOHC. The breeds were not specified, but it implied that they were seen in breeds other than Spaniels. So is this significant? And the starting point is, what is the incidence of IOHC in a normal population? Well, to answer that question, Andy Moores with his co-workers published a paper in 2012 in which 50 non-lame Springer Spaniels were evaluated, both elbows, using CT. These were not dogs that had had any fractures or so on and so forth. They found AOHC in 14%, and all the fissures were incomplete. So they can be present, and without following that population of dogs, there is no way of knowing whether they would have ever developed fracture. So its presence and the consequence of that are still very much unknown. All of this suggests that some breeds or particular dogs have a developmental anomaly that predisposes to humeral condylar fracture as a consequence of minimal trauma. But then, why does this progress to humeral condylar fissure or incomplete fracture? Is it because there's an underlying incongruency? And the underlying incongruency might have caused the IOHC in the first place by preventing ossification between the two parts of the condyle. And then that incongruency may cause abnormal stress in the bone, leading to failure or fatigue failure. So in fact, some humeral condyle fractures might be stress fractures with developmental undercurrents, which the developmental side of it is what's producing the stress leading to fracture. Now, is this significant? Well, many people believe that it is, and that it may influence how we treat fracture patients. I question that, and we will look at that when we come through to complications. Turning now to the history. In the case of fracture, obviously, we're expecting trauma, though it may be low-level trauma, and we should ask about any prodromal lameness. It's interesting how many owners, when asked, directly provoked, has your dog been lame for 2 or 3 weeks prior to this, how many actually will say, yes, they have. I thought it was just something and nothing. So again, if they've had a prodromal lameness, this may lead us to think the dog has been developing a fissure, and then that finally went on to fracture. So it's a question always worth asking in the history. In the case of condylar fissure, HSCF, then the lameness will come and go. It's very difficult to localize the pain, and it gets worse generally with exercise and is better. So these dogs are better after rest and become lame, or the lameness worsens with exercise. The clinical signs, again, splitting them into fracture and fissure. In the case of fracture, we've got a severe lameness, obviously, a swollen elbow, crepitation. Easy to detect that there's something seriously wrong in the vicinity of the elbow, but it's not always easy to determine configuration. There are clues with regard to the relative displacement of the epicondyles as to whether it is a medial condylar fracture, a lateral condylar fracture, or a Y fracture. But quite often that's something that is going to be defined by radiography. And although it's a question that might be asked in a certificate exam, it's not really of that much practical value, because radiographs are going to give you the answer. As I mentioned with clinical signs, with fissure, it's difficult to localize the pain. But in my experience, if the dog shows pain on an elbow extension but not flexion, then that gives me great cause for suspicion that they have a condylar fissure. Presumably, as you extend the elbow, the anconeus is pushed into the olecranon fossa, and that stresses the condyle and causes the fissure to try and open, and therefore causes pain, whereas flexion does not stress the condyle. So just a useful tip that if it's extension, not flexion, in a spaniel that's lame at exercise, then I'd have very strong suspicions. So diagnosis needs to be made early, especially in young patients. Young patients will be trying to heal from the moment the fracture occurs, and malunion will develop very quickly. And the image on this slide shows a 5-month Springer Spaniel, which had become acutely lame 3 weeks earlier, and because the lameness hadn't resolved, the radiograph was taken, and unfortunately at that stage we have a malunion that would be incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to do anything with. Or we can have a problematic non-union. This patient was an 8-month-old French bulldog, acutely lame in the middle of October, was treated conservatively, variable lameness for 4 months, and then became acutely worse. And at the time of examination, it was 3/10 lame. That's the radiograph, and unfortunately we have got evidence of a non-union with bone resorption on the fracture surfaces and a lot of scar tissue around there, making it very difficult, and my decision was not possible to improve the dog by any attempt at trying to reduce and stabilize that fracture. Radiography is generally definitive. We take mediolateral and craniocaudal, or in some cases caudocranial fracture views for particularly Y fractures. And we should be able to tell whether we are dealing with a lateral condylar fracture or a medial condylar fracture or a Y fracture. A horizontal beam radiograph with the limb under traction can be very useful. And you can see in this example here, in the left-hand image, this is taken as a vertical beam craniocaudal view, and there's a degree of obliquity there. It's not as easy to draw an elbow to straight with a fracture there as it is, for example, when you're trying to radiograph a dog with elbow dysplasia. So here I would say there's some uncertainty as to whether that is a lateral condylar fracture, sorry, a medial condylar fracture, or a Y fracture. But with a horizontal beam view, we can quite clearly see that the lateral epicondyle is intact, and this is indeed a medial condylar fracture. Now, how do we take that radiograph? Well, it is a horizontal beam, so in this image you can see the dog's lying on its side with the affected limb uppermost. I'll declare straight away this is not a fracture. This is a dog that was being radiographed for an elbow lameness, but not a fracture. And the leg is being drawn into traction by attachment to what is actually the x-ray machine. And the x-ray tube head is on the far left of the image, shooting the x-ray beam horizontally at the screen. Now, that is a very useful way. Unfortunately, many clinics these days, particularly with digital imaging setups, cannot produce horizontal beam radiographs. And if that is the case, I'm reliably informed from colleagues that you can get a better view taken in a quarter cranial direction, because then you can traction the leg better by drawing it cranially over past the dog's head. It will probably give you a lot of geometric distortion because the elbow will be quite a long way from the cassette, but nevertheless it will enable you to tell the configuration of the fracture. We also radiograph the contralateral elbow. Why do we do that? For measurements, for contours, to give us an idea of how we might need to contour a plate. What measurements, as you can see on the sketch below the radiographs here, I've measured out where I'm going to put a bone screw and what length that should be, so that during surgery I can check that, yes, this is working as I thought it should, and how far it is to the fracture, which is generally halfway. It's usually very, very close. If, for example, there you've got 30 mil distance, it's likely to be very close to 15 and 15. In this case, it's 16 and 14. But it's generally halfway across that distance. And we look for incomplete fracture, or IOHC, or humeral condylar fissure, whatever terminology is being used at the day, in the opposite leg. Now, should that affect what we do? Well, that's a good question, but it is something that we do look for. Be very careful of the so-called MAC line, or a MAC line. A MAC line is an artifact created by two overlapping bones. So the overlapping ulna can produce a line passing through the humeral condyle. Probably the simplest way of trying to rule that out is that a genuine fissure will stop at the olecranon and fossa and at the elbow joint surface. Often with a MAC line that's created by the ulna, that fissure, so-called fissure, passes across the elbow and into the antebrachium. Now, if it does that, it's an artifact. It cannot be a condylar fissure. And we also look for remodeling. Remodeling, if I can just get a little arrow in here, is just on this image here. I'll move the arrow away so that it's not in everybody's way to see it. But that area is remodeled. So that's a stress remodeling. And that's an indication that something is happening in the condyle and the epicondylar bone is responding to that. Diagnosis of incomplete fracture or condylar fissure requires advanced imaging in many cases. Now, CT is perfectly adequate. MRI will also detect it. Arthroscopy is perhaps not the choice, not the best option, because it is invasive. But it may be less expensive, for example, than if combined with treatment, than taking a dog to MRI first. So any of those ways, but it's usually least invasive of those. If you're sure it's that's what you're looking for, then CT is probably the most economical. But MRI gives you more information if it turns out that there isn't such a fissure there. So how do we treat these? Well, we start with lateral, that's the commonest. We use a lateral approach, it's a textbook approach, well recorded to expose the distal humerus. Often said that be careful of the radial nerve. I would agree you do need to be careful of the radial nerve, but it's not something that you generally see in a typical exposure for this fracture. But if you want to go looking for it just to make sure you preserve it, that's fine. But it's not something that's generally in the way. So we make that lateral approach. I have the dog in lateral recumbency with the affected limb uppermost and a sandbag so that when the leg is draped and the leg is then laid down onto that sandbag, then the leg is parallel to the table. Without that sandbag, then obviously the leg would be hanging down, and it just makes seeing the lines and anatomy that bit more difficult if the leg is not parallel to something else that you've got reference to. So the exposure then allows us to take the lateral condylar portion and rotate it outwards in order to create a gliding hole in a retrograde fashion. Okay, now in doing that, you can see that I've placed Alice tissue forceps on the epicondylar ridge. And all I would say is be very careful doing that with immature patients. The radiographs up on the left-hand side are of an immature patient with a lateral condylar fracture. And if I just put the arrow where the growth plate is, there, at the base of the epicondylar ridge, if you were to take hold of the epicondylar ridge with Alice tissue forceps and rotate it viciously, it is quite possible to snap that ridge off at the level of the physis. So it's something you just need to be a little bit careful of with young patients. You can place a lagged bone screw in a direct fashion by reducing the fracture and drilling the glide hole from the lateral surface to the fracture line. But I would advise anybody starting with this that it's safer to drill this hole in a retrograde fashion. Then you know that the screw crosses the fracture line in the center of the condyle. If you're working from the lateral aspect inwards, then it is faster. It requires less soft tissue dissection, but you've got to know you're in the right place. And I think until you've gained a little bit of experience, it's safer to do a retrograde glide hole. So we've created the glide hole with whichever drill is appropriate for the screw that we're going to use, and we've kept the tissues moistened. I would also say that in drilling this hole, the bone that comes out of the drill flutes, I will often collect. Okay, just keep them to one side. Okay, it's a free bone graft, if you like. So that's something worth just thinking about. Then we reduce the fracture and we need to stabilize it. Now, the top left-hand corner diagram using condylar forceps is great if it works. Often the forceps, in order to stop them from rotating the fragment, the forceps will have to be placed where the screw needs to go. So they're not very helpful. So the two that I've circled there, using a K-wire, either in the condyle itself, if there's room for that and the screw, or through the epicondylar ridge, are the main techniques that I would use to secure this. And if need be, I'm perfectly happy to place that K-wire, as in picture C, but a little bit lower, so that it's actually crossing the foramen. So it's starting down here, and it's crossing the foramen. Okay, now I'm not going to leave that in permanently, but I'm perfectly happy to put it across there whilst I place the bone screw. We then reduced it. We have a K-wire in place, as shown here. We insert a sleeve into the glide hole, and that allows us to drill the pilot hole. So in this case, it's a Springer spanner, it's probably a 4.5 millimeter glide hole and then a 3.2 millimeter pilot hole to allow us to place a 4.5 millimeter bone screw. We then measure the depth, and again, this would we check this against what we thought we had from the preoperative radiographs when we took our measurement. Does this depth measure what we are expecting it to measure? If it's way out, then something could be seriously wrong. If it's slightly out, is that because we've angled the screw? Does it matter? And so on. So it just gives us a reference back to what we thought in the first place. Tap the screw if you're not using self-tapping screws, obviously. But I will often only partially tap. Probably not in an adult Springer because they've got really hard bone in the condyle. But if it's a puppy, I would just start the tap in the far fragment just to get the screw started. It's going into cancellous bone. It will tap itself in even if it's not a self-tapping screw. Okay, and it gives it very, very good purchase. We've placed the leg screw. Do we use a washer? Some people will always use washers. I tend not to, unless I'm dealing with a very young puppy and I am concerned that the screw, from the feel of the bone, from the drilling and the tapping, the bone is likely to allow the screw head to drive itself into the condyle. In which case, yes, I would put a plain washer on there. But it's not something that I would consider doing in an adult dog at all. Check the range of motion. Obviously, if you've placed your KY deliberately across the olecranon fossa, you can't do that until you've removed it. But we check the range of motion to check that everything's as it should be. And then we're going to put an anti-rotational implant across the epicondylar fracture line. Now, we've checked if we've placed, for example, in the left-hand picture here, we've placed a screw, we've checked the movement, everything's okay. We place the K-wire, we check the range of motion again. If suddenly it's not as it should be, then it's the K-wire's fault. If you haven't checked halfway through, then you don't know which implant it is that's the problem. Should we use a K-wire? Should we use a plate? Well, we'll come back to complications of that. My general attitude to this is if the dog is immature, then I will use a K-wire. If it is mature, I will use a plate, a bone plate. But we'll come back to that point in complications. Now, recently, the beginning of this year, there was a paper produced from Italy in VCOT. I haven't got that reference, but they'd used just K-wires and shown that in puppies, i.e. dogs less than 7 months of age, you can get perfectly adequate fixation, stabilization and healing of condylar fractures in those puppies with just K-wires. That is probably a good plan if you really feel the condyle is so fragile. That's not something I've ever met. It's something I'd consider in future. But one of the problems with just using KYs is they had a 28% occurrence of having to remove one or more of the KYs because of migration. And that concerns me. That's one in four puppies having to go back to for a minor procedure, but nevertheless another procedure. So something to keep in mind as a possibility, but not the ideal in my mind. So what about medial? Well, medial is pretty much a mirror image of the lateral. We just use a medial approach, we retrograde the gliding hole, etc., etc. So it is very much a mirror image. Often the medial fragment is large enough to take leg screws in the epicondylar component. Okay, so we may be able to use screws there. That's very infrequently possible in lateral condylar fractures, but quite often possible in medial condylar fractures. However, the really tricky ones on the medial side are these fellows, where the fracture is actually a type 3 Salter-Harris fracture, where it's fractured along the physis, so from the joint surface to the physis and then out along the physis. Very, very small fragment, difficult to orientate and difficult to stabilize. So medial condylar fractures for me go into two categories. the big pieces that are easy to deal with and the small pieces that are very fiddly to deal with. When we come to Y or T fractures or intercondylar fractures, which I don't like intercondylar because there aren't two condyles, but these are a challenge even to the most experienced of surgeons. I don't think there's anybody I know who says they relish the thought of doing a Y fracture on a Monday morning. There's a number of issues with surgical approach and method of fixation, so we'll just run through some of those features. So originally, go back in time to when I was training, and we all used caudal approach. We used a caudal approach, a lecanon osteotomy, identified the three pieces of bone, we placed a transcondylar leg screw across the condyle, and then reattached the condyle to the shaft, generally with a caudomedial or medial plate. And that's basically this was the standard procedure, and we ended up with something along these lines, which we're all happy with, except that there were a lot of complications. Many of those complications related to the tissue dissection and the olecranon osteotomy. So we needed that osteotomy, we needed extensive fascial incision, reduction of condylar fragments was difficult because you have to lift the forearm up all the time to take the to keep the humeral shaft from keeping the two components of the condyle apart. As you place a caudal plate, it runs off the bone proximally, so you want to get medial, which means more soft tissue dissection, and closure requires reattachment of the olecranon. Okay, I always used a screw and tension band wire. A lot of people use pins. A lot of reports of non-healing of the olecranon, which was interesting. It's not something that I saw, but then it could come down to technique. I always used a jiggly wire. A lot of people use power saws, and maybe the power saws are the issue, that they're creating heat and therefore inhibiting healing. Immediately post-op, these patients show massively reduced flexion, and that's presumably the soft tissue dissection and stitching thereof causes a lot of problems on the caudal aspect of the joint. So we started to move towards a medial approach, a medial plate, so reattach the medial part of the condyle onto the shaft, and then flip the dog over and do a lateral approach and treat it as a lateral condylar fracture. Seems easy, the first few go well, and then not so good. You can see in this image that there is a lag screw in the, just there, attaching the medial component to the shaft. Now that is a win-win because that is accurately reducing that fracture, and the plate is then acting as a neutralization plate. So that's a good situation to be in for this technique. What's not such a good situation is this, where there is no way of placing an intrafragmentary implant. So the accuracy of reduction is governed completely by the contouring of the plate. That means if you get it wrong, you end up with a situation as shown here, and you can then treat it as a lateral condylar fracture, but the lateral component won't fit in correctly because the medial component isn't where it's supposed to be. So there's issues with that, but if you can reconstruct the medial epicondylar fracture before applying the plate, then you're in much stronger position than where this situation, where you are totally dependent on getting the contouring of the plate correct. If possible, in order to avoid that, we try and reconstruct the condyle first. So in this situation, the condyle has been reconstructed with a medial to lateral transcondylar bone screw, and then the condyle has been reattached to the shaft with a medial plate, and then for support, flipped over and a lateral epicondylar plate applied. But that can be very difficult to achieve condylar reduction from a medial approach is quite difficult, particularly if the medial epicondylar ridge is quite high. If this is low, then you can see past it. But if the fracture is very high, then it's difficult to see what's happening beyond that epicondylar ridge. If we're dealing with young patients, again, then rather than a lateral plate, I would be more than happy to use a lateral K-wire for that component. And you can see here we've used a medial approach, a lag screw to secure the medial epicondylar ridge, or two lag screws in fact, and then placed a locking plate, in this case it's a SOP plate, to protect those screws. But the plate is locking, therefore it does not try and contour the bone to the plate. So we've got around the problem of a miscontoured plate pulling this medial fragment out of position. But that fragment is being held in position with those two lag screws. And then we've treated it as a lateral condylar fracture with a transcondylar screw and in this case, a K-wire, because we're dealing with an immature patient. This is an idea, this courtesy of John Ferguson. This is an idea John had because to get over this problem of using an X-fix. He presented it at BVOA and everyone thought, wow, that seems like a really good idea, because we all have problems with these plates changing the relationship of the bone fragments. But unfortunately, although the first few went extremely well, like a lot of new techniques, John then found there were quite a few complications and has abandoned that. So nice idea, worth keeping there as an option, but it's certainly not a panacea for dealing with these. So mentioned in the immature patients, we may elect to use a K-wire on the lateral side, or in this case, we've actually used a transcondylar leg screw and K-wires on both sides. So we can possibly, in very young puppies, it's a four-month-old border collie, we can avoid using plates altogether. And I think it does make it a lot neater. They heal so fast, and screw purchase in very young puppies can be an issue, and therefore plates can be difficult to apply. So just an alternative for the immature patient. What about incomplete fractures? Well, we've got standard bone screws that we've been using for quite a long time. We've placed these as positional lag. That's a moot point. Some people prefer positional screws. Some people prefer lag screws. The argument's a bit circular in the advantages and disadvantages. A lag screw offers the potential for causing fusion, but it also creates the potential for changing the relationship of the two parts of the condyle, and therefore making it incongruous and therefore generating arthritis. So it's a bit of a difficult one. You would like to see fusion, but at the same time you don't want to cause a problem by lag screw fixation. So I think it somewhat depends on how wide the fissure is. If it's very wide, I would place a positional screw. If it's virtually invisible and only been detected on CT, then I would place a lag screw. So we're going to put the largest screw that we can fit in. Why? Why do we do that? Well, it's on the assumption that this fissure may never heal. And if it doesn't, we are dependent on the strength of that bone screw forever. Now, AMI, or area moment of inertia, is a measure of how much stress that implant will stand. And in the case of a cylindrical implant, such as a screw, then the AMI is equal to pi times the radius to the power 4 over 4. So a small change in radius makes a big difference to the AMI. If we calculate that out for a 3.5 millimeter bone screw, bearing in mind a 3.5 millimeter bone screw has a core 2.4 millimeters, which is the therefore the radius is 1.2 millimetres, that's the thing we're working with, then the AMI works out to 1.63. If we do the same for a 4.5 millimetre bone screw, it works out to 4.53. So a 4.5 millimetre bone screw in this sense is nearly three times stronger than the 3.5 millimetre screw. So it's got a better chance of going the distance. We could also consider drilling bone tunnels across to encourage fusion. However, we're a bit strapped if we've put the largest implant we can in. So it's an idea again, but quite difficult. Initially, we placed them lateral to medial as shown in the picture. Then we changed medial to lateral, and this will come on to complications, but seroma formation is a massive complication. It's not a big issue, it's not a clinical issue, but it's pretty unsightly. And somebody came up with a bright idea of switching to medial, placing them from medial to lateral, and that seems to have resolved the majority of those seroma issues. And it obviously doesn't make any difference in terms of its function in treating the fissure. Shaft screws have been developed, which give a better AMI. These show a wider shaft of metal crossing the fissure and only threaded at the end. Now that does give, as we've said, 4.5 millimeter bone screw, AMI 4.53, shaft screw 30.69, so it's nearly seven times stronger. Now the difficulties, these are much more difficult to place and you don't get much thread purchase. My concern here would be if you strip that little bit of bone there holding onto that thread, where do you go next? Because this is, its outside diameter is 5 millimetres. So you can't put a 4.5 millimetre screw in there. You'd have to go to at least a 5.5 and you've lost most of the thread area here. So in this area here. So I'd be concerned that this is great, but it's more difficult to place, and if it goes wrong, it might leave you very limited room for manoeuvre. And more recently, these newer techniques of newer implants, this is a titanium implant, which has threads on the screw head and on the tip, and a small barrel-shaped bit in the middle, which crosses the fissure. It's got a special drill guide because these are all different core diameters. So you have to drill the bit for this thread different to this bit and different to the screw head. And you place that across. It's a self-compressing screw. So as you tighten the screw, it pushes the two components of the condyle towards one another. And then there's a gap around this barrel in the middle into which, just before you finish tightening the screw, you introduce DBM putty. That's demineralized bone matrix, to encourage fusion. Okay, so that's the next level up. But whether it's going to be any better remains to be seen. So let's take post-operative care. Bandage, no, I don't use a bandage. Exercise, it's cage or pen, room rest and lead exercise. Physiotherapy, I don't use. Unless dogs are not making good progress, so they're checked at 3 weeks. If they're not making progress, physio will be considered, but they don't automatically go to physio. And follow-up radiography after 4 to 6 weeks to assess healing, perhaps a little bit longer in an older patient, but to assess healing before they're allowed off the lead again. What complications do we see? Well, after lateral humeral condylar fractures, 20% of cases that were in one report showed implant failure. And in a different report by Karen Perry, of cases treated with leg screw and pin, 28% showed failure. The same study showed much reduced complication rate in cases with leg screw and epicondylar screw or plate. And very recently, an in vitro study showed that plate fixation in cadavers is superior to pin fixation. So they tested load to failure, and those with a plate on the lateral epicondyle stood up to more pressure than those treated with a pin, which is probably fairly common sense, but it has been shown experimentally. So from that, it would seem that, right, the plate is the better way to go. But in Karen Perry's paper, they also showed that infection is seen three times as often with epicondylar screw or plate fixation rather than a pin. So which goes back to my point that if a pin will suffice, then it may be better to use the pin. The last question, is IOHC or humeral condylar fissure a risk factor for complications? Nothing has been shown to that effect. So the take-home message from that is that although we may have had to change our opinion on how to treat lateral condylar fractures, the presence or absence of humeral condylar fissure is not going to change how we treat them. So we don't treat them any differently, we're just aware that there may be other issues in progress. So with incomplete fractures, I've mentioned that seroma was a major problem when the screw is placed from lateral to medial, and therefore we tend to place it from medial to lateral. How often do we see implant failure? Well, in a study that I did with John Innes, we had 1 out of 12 or 8% showed implant failure. And then Rachel Hasley put together a paper with 17, from multicenter paper, 79 elbows, 3% developed implant failure. So it's not as bad as perhaps we perceive, but we are trying to improve it. Whether these new techniques, the new technology will reduce that remains to be seen. And of course, it may reduce that and create a different problem. So in the bottom right-hand corner, you see there's an x-ray taken of his 2-year-old Springer Spaniel. It had a lateral condylar fracture repair at 4 months of age. The dog recovered full function in the leg, and then at 2 years of age, became lame for 1 week, and then became very lame, and the radiograph shown was taken, where you can see the screw is broken, the K-wire has migrated, and we have a Y fracture developed in the distal humeral condyle. So a pretty tricky thing to have to deal with, which is why we'd prefer not to see it, but whether the new techniques will improve that remains to be seen. Prognosis is very subjective. In the lateral and medial condylar fractures, then I think it's generally accepted that with reasonable experience, you can expect 85% of patients to regain excellent, which basically means normal, or good, which basically means near normal, function in that leg. In the case of a Y fracture, probably only 50 to 70%. And to some extent, I would bias my prognosis to an owner according to the actual radiographic features. As to whether we can reduce it with leg screws or whether we're going to have to rely on a plate that has to be contoured accurately. So I think that all those factors mean that the Y fractures are not all the same and therefore hence a range of prognosis. In incomplete fractures or humeral condylar fissures, the study that myself and John Innes put together, lameness resolved in all. We had late complications in 2 and both responded perfectly adequately to further treatment. So there's no issue with treatment of those complications. The new devices, it's hoped that they will improve that success rate and reduce the complication rate, but we don't have that information to say that that is indeed true. So in summary, we've looked at how to suspect a humeral condylar fracture from the clinical signs, how to make a definitive diagnosis and with some reference to particular radiographic techniques, how to treat lateral condylar fractures, which are 56% of the population of these fractures, the potential complications, how Y fractures are in a completely different league. And I would say that a surgeon should have a lot of experience with lateral condylar fractures before they decide to embark on treating Y fractures. the issues that surround incomplete fractures, and also that perhaps in some ways more is being made of those than is really appropriate. There's no reason to think that lateral condylar fractures associated with HCF should be treated any differently. We just may have to warn owners of the other leg becoming involved, or the potential for different complications down the line if the fissure does not heal. And that basically no humeral condylar fractures are simple. Even the lateral ones, which were always given over as being fairly straightforward fractures, I think there's a lot of hidden opportunity for problems, even with those lateral condylar fractures. So that's the end of my talk. Just to run through the references, there's three slides. I have to do this for the recording so that you can come back and look at them later, so I'm not going to expect you to read them. But if there are any questions, then I'm more than happy to try and answer them. Okay. I have one question. Just waiting for it to type out. Okay. The spaniel that had the fracture 2 years after the lateral condylar fracture. Actually, I'm glad you asked that. I thought somebody might pick up on that and ask about that patient. What did we do with it, and how did she get on? Well, fortuitously, I thought that might get asked. So this is the patient. This is the X-rays taken by the original veterinary surgeon when the puppy was treated for the lateral condylar fracture. And I think that the work here, it's not a great radiograph, but the work here, the leg screw across the condyle, KY across the epicondyle, looks pretty good to me. I'm not saying there's not room for improvement, but it looks fairly reasonable as an attempt. And obviously the dog did become sound after that treatment. This is what happened, as you've seen this picture in the center already. So it changed from this, recovered, and then fractured. So obviously, or presumably, the fissure never healed. The dog was walking, as you could call it, on the screw, which is then quite a small screw for the size of patient, and that patient would have got heavier, and that's failed. So it is a big challenge. So we've got a problem. This piece of screw has got to be taken out, the distal end. Has got to be taken out. This piece, the proximal end of the screw, will fall out. The KY won't be too much of a problem. Then we've got to repair it. So how do we go about that? Well, that's the post-ops. We went about it by, from the medial side, take out the bit of screw, the distal end of that screw, push the other screw out through the wound. We managed to retrieve the proximal end of the screw as well. Reduce the medial side and place a lag screw using the same holes, but it's a bigger screw, so it's reversed. We've made a gliding hole on the medial side and a pilot hole on the lateral side, and enlarged the screw to fit that same hole. Then reattached the medial part to the humeral shaft, placed a locking plate over here, and then on the same on the lateral side. So it's, I think we had to keep juggling sides to get that done. It was quite a long procedure, but at the end of the day, the elbow still moved fairly well, and we did have to use a little bit of physiotherapy to get optimum treatment, but I think we ended up with a dog who was no more than 1/10 lame when signed off at about 4 months post-surgery. So that was pretty much the end of that, but it was not too bad. Okay, I have another question. I don't have any images for this. Why are seromas more common with a lateral than medial approach? Nobody can actually explain that. We don't see seromas when we treat lateral condylar fractures. And so I think many of us were surprised when we started seeing quite big seromas. You know, golf ball size is not unknown by to any stretch. It was felt perhaps it because we weren't opening up the skin as much for an approach just to put a transcondylar leg screw in, that we couldn't close the soft tissues properly. So we started making the wounds bigger in order to be able to do so, but it didn't stop the seromas. So that was the end of that theory. Going from the medial side, I don't know why anybody thought of doing that as to why it would help. It is more difficult to place the screw from the medial side, but maybe they thought it would be less cosmetic because it's on the medial side. But having done it, we don't see, sometimes see small seromas, but you don't see the big seromas. So no, I can't explain it. Whether it's to do with blood supply, I've really no idea. It's just a fact that's been accepted. But it is harder. If it was, the seromas were the same both ways, everyone would put the screws in from the lateral side because it's a lot easier. But the orientation of the medial epicondyle tends to make you direct the screw proximally. It's really not easy to keep the screw parallel to the joint surface just because of the surface that you're trying to drill into. It's angled and it tends to throw you proximally. But no, I'm sorry, I can't answer the question as to why it's more common. So that's all the questions. I think we're just about on time. So I think we can close the webinar. Thank you very much for your attention. I hope you enjoyed that. And we'll go back and look over it again. Thank you.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Stephen for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.